You're listening to At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends and themes in fixed income, currency, and commodity markets today. I'm your host, Jay Barry, co-head of U.S. Rate Strategy and U.S. Government Bond Strategist here at JP Morgan. It's been a big week in the U.S., laden with event risk. We had ECI earlier in the week. The potent combination of both the Treasury refunding announcement and the FOMC on Wednesday, which absorbed most of our time. And then, of course, the employment report just a bit earlier today. And it's had clear implications for macro markets. So thought it would be appropriate this week to kind of partner up with my partner, Meera Chandan, who is co-head of FX strategy and here to join me today. Meera, thanks a lot for joining.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, anytime. So obviously a big week and U.S. rates are lower, curves are steeper, dollar's weaker this week. Should we just go dig right in and talk about what the implications have been for FX markets this week?
Yeah, you know, I like nothing more than talking about the dollar, but let me just hijack the discussion a bit because I think your market is actually the source of a lot of the most of the macro markets volatility that we're seeing. So maybe we can start with rates first, and then we move on to FX, because I think a lot of things you say are actually going to be affecting FX as well.
So yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay, so let's just start with the big question. You know, we've clearly had the move higher in rates against the backdrop of cheap valuations. And you have been pointing out that that the valuations did suggest in treasuries that the sell-off was hitting a mature stage, and rates have finally fallen this time for the first week since late March. And that was despite the hard ECI and data and the unit labor cost data. So clearly markets were most focused on Powell and NFP. What are the takeaways and implications for rates from here? Is this enough to change your views on overall duration?
No, I'm glad you asked that, and thanks a lot. I think in a word, it does not change our view on duration. But to take a step back, I think you're right. We do feel comforted here with what's happened over the past week, and front-end yields have declined more than 15 basis points on the week, and the broad curve is about 10 basis points steeper. We do feel really comfortable, I think, that we are at a more mature stage of the sell-off, like you've said. Compared with the other big moves we've had after the GFC, this is kind of consistent in both timing and magnitude that it should be sort of petering out. And again, you also mentioned that we've had this very strong support of valuations as well. So I think the fact that rates have moved lower this week after the markets interpreted Powell in a more dovish fashion and watching this morning's employment report, I think it's a comfort, but I'm not necessarily convinced that we're out of the woods so far. So we don't think there's a reason to chase yields lower. And I think there's a couple of important reasons for that. So first, you know, very clear from the Fed earlier this week that while there was some horse trading that went on and that the statement looked a bit more hawkish than the prior statement in March, and that the prepared remarks that Powell made were certainly in line with what he said just a couple of weeks ago, his Q&A at the press conference was certainly less hawkish than we would have expected. Really talking about how he's convinced that policy is still restrictive here. Moreover, having confidence that he sees rental inflation moderating further. And then finally, and probably most importantly, that he kind of talked about a three potential states in the world, one in which inflation moderates, the Fed eases, a second in which inflation doesn't moderate as much as the Fed thought, and the Fed potentially stays on hold for longer, and a third in which there's this sort of exogenous weakening in the labor markets that drives a big sort of set of easing, but didn't talk about hiking at all. So that was dovish and certainly supportive of front-end yields falling. But I think we know that this all comes down to inflation data. So we're going to have to wait another 2 weeks or so until we get the CPI reading for April to see whether we continue to see these hot trends of inflation that we've seen in the first quarter of this year. And until we get through that, it's hard for me to consider that we're going to follow through to lower yield levels from here. So I think we're kind of still being patient on duration at the moment because of that. And more imminently, we have Treasury supply to underwrite next week. And it is mainly long-duration Treasury supply from the refunding auctions. And while this data this week, both in employment and in Powell's comments, are, I think, supportive here, you know, we're definitely of the mind that in an environment in which the Fed could be anywhere from 4 to 6 months away from potentially cutting, at least if you're looking at the markets, then the incentive for end users to extend duration here in an inverted yield curve environment may be somewhat high, or not the, I think the bar for investors to extend duration right now is pretty high. So I think it's very possible that long rates remain pretty elevated, knowing that we've got more event risk in 2 weeks' time, knowing we've got supply to underwrite next week. And I think instead, you know, we're really focused on the front end. And I think it's notable that if you look at something like one-year OIS as a representation of how the market's pricing the Fed for the next year or two, we kind of got up to about 460, 465 this week. So markets at the minimum pricing of Fed that would ease about 75 basis points over the next 1 to 2 years. And that's been kind of a support level over the course of the past 18 to 24 months or so. So I think we, against the backdrop of a Fed which is still on hold and an inverted curve, would be more comfortable adding duration at the front end. But I think only if we got back to those yield levels. And you know, I think we do think that we're not out of the woods, because we'll have to see what the inflation data for the month of April actually show us from here.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's, I think, that's the problem. We're going from data point to data point here. It's really hard because, you know, I feel like this was such a pivotal week, and now we are once again looking ahead in 2 weeks' time when we get the inflation print. But let's also talk about quantitative tightening, though. And, you know, I do think this is broadly, you know, big picture themes on that front are relevant for the dollar, although not so much for this meeting. But, you know, it was, the outcome there was slightly different from our expectations. What are the implications for markets from that decision? And then separately, I think it was also interesting that the Treasury is forecasting $850 billion TGA for the third quarter. That was larger than expected. You know, what can we take away from that?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to kind of tackle both of those questions. So I think on the QT announcement, and that kind of went under the radar amid everything else on Wednesday afternoon, the Fed did announce that effective next month in June, it will be cutting the monthly Treasury runoff caps from $60 billion a month down to $25 billion a month. And that was slightly different than we would have expected. We were expecting the announcement this Wednesday to be effective immediately because the meeting was early in the month, and that the runoff caps would be cut in half to $30 billion a month. But in aggregate, when you trade that 1 month later start with the slightly larger cut and the slightly larger taper, and in reality, it makes a difference of just $5 billion in Treasury runoff this year versus our prior expectations. And on a baseline of a Fed SOMA portfolio that owns about $4.5 trillion in Treasuries, it really doesn't make a dent. Overall, I think the slowing pace of QT from a rates and rate curve perspective is on margin beginning to come a bigger support overall. But the Fed share of the Treasury market will continue to decline over time, particularly in the context of the very large deficits that we continue to run. And if anything, that should be something that helps you think that long rates will remain better elevated and that yield curves will be steeper over time, because all of our work has found that the Fed share of the Treasury market, as it increases, it brings down long-term rates, it flattens the yield curve. So the slow ongoing unwind of that will kind of continue to put pressure there, but just at not the same rate that we've seen so far this year. But overall, it was in line with what we would have expected. And we continue to think that QT can run through the end of the year. I think so far, secured financing rates and the SOFR rate have been very well behaved. We have seen the drift down in the Fed's liability as a function of QT pivot from RRP, as it was from like June last year until just about a month ago, to reserves. But if we're right, we do think that, you know, we can end this year with reserves close to $3 trillion and the RRP balance is close to $300 billion without encountering any sort of issues. And the Fed taking this step this week is sort of consistent with that. So on the margin, you know, a little bit different from what we expected, but overall in the macro context, very limited difference versus our baseline expectations and very limited impact for rates overall. But I think more interesting, perhaps for the narrative that's out there, is your second question, which is the Treasury's cash balance, because I think there was a lot of discussion over the course of the last few weeks about how there could be room for the Treasury's general account to move significantly lower later this year, in large part because we know that the debt ceiling suspension comes to a close at the end of this year. That legislation expires. And historically, there's been evidence that the Treasury let its cash balance run down heading into that suspension because it really can't carry extra cash. It could only carry enough sort of cash on hand to kind of meet its outlays over the period. And, you know, we were of the mind that heading into this end of this debt ceiling suspension period later this year, that the Treasury had a lot more flexibility with the way the legislation was written. And indeed, there was a memo out from the Justice Department a few weeks ago talking about the debt ceiling debate in 2021, which basically ratified that this operational policy that the Treasury has had to maintain enough cash to withstand 1 week of outflows, you know, is sort of valid with respect to the debt ceiling. So that's worth about $750 to $775 billion in cash right now. And I think, you know, this announcement from Treasury earlier this week targeting $850 billion in TGA at the end of the third quarter is consistent with that. It is a bit higher than we would have expected, but I think that just could be some mechanical issues related to the calendar and knowing that quarter end falls on a business day and that it's got major outlays the next couple of days after that. But either way, this ratifies for me, it's unlikely we're going to see the TGA move materially lower later this year. And there are limited implications for that for me overall, other than the fact that it means that it won't be a, you know, a bigger sort of, you know, drawdown in issuance than you would have expected overall.
Okay. And then I guess we also had the quarterly refunding announcement on Wednesday. And you and I were discussing this before the event on how some macro investors thought it could be a factor that actually lowers yields. But, you know, so far this year, refunding announcements have really been less impactful on macro markets than they were last year. Why is that in your view?
I think you're right, Mira, because overall, the Treasury Department attempts to sort of comport itself such that it leads markets in a direction over a period of time, so that's such that policy announcements are not a surprise. And I think the refunding announcements were very impactful on macro markets, and in particular on rates last year, because market participants were, I think, taken aback by the open-ended nature of increases to auction sizes that was announced last summer in August. And then similarly, I think, surprised in November when the Treasury Department not only cut the pace of its issuance increases, but then gave very firm guidance to the markets that these increases would likely be done after the February through April period. So if we kind of go back to where we've been, we had been getting this guidance for 6 months that the round of increases we saw last quarter were the last in this cycle. And indeed, that's what we got on Wednesday morning. Long duration coupon auction size is unchanged. And we think that the Treasury has put itself in a pretty good spot for now, where it's got enough borrowing capacity as it stands to meet its financing needs over the coming year. And I think it's done a good job of communicating that to the markets. But if we take a step back, I think the one thing to be potentially concerned about over the coming years, and this is something that we've been talking about in our pieces, but it's not sort of first order with all these other uncertainties with related to labor markets growth, inflation, and Fed policy that's sort of been driving rates markets. But as we get into the later part of next year and beyond that, this sort of current auction schedule is just not enough for the Treasury to fund itself over time. And even from a baseline perspective, it would seem that the Treasury Department in the coming years will need to create an additional $3 trillion of borrowing capacity. And certainly it can create a significant amount of that vis-a-vis Treasury bills. But it means at some point that it's going to have to go through another significant set of increases to coupon auction sizes beginning at some point next year. And I think previously we had expected that maybe this was a spring to summer event, but in the context of how the Treasury's borrowing needs for even just the coming quarters were a little bit larger than we would have expected, that might have been brought forward to maybe potentially next winter or next spring. So it's not high on the radar right now. It didn't move markets on Wednesday, but in the back of my mind, this is something that's important for me right now as well. But I think enough about rates markets right now, Mira. We've spent too much time talking about treasury issuance and all the underpinnings right there. I just want to turn to you and ask you, I mean, you've been steadfastly long the dollar throughout the year, but Powell was certainly dovish on Wednesday, and then payrolls were certainly softer than the markets had expected today. Is this enough to consider a rethink on the broad dollar view that you've had for a number of months now?
Yeah, look, I think the points that you made are quite interesting. And, you know, surely Powell was dovish, but I think what we've seen very clearly with market behavior is Powell can say whatever he wants to say. At the end of the day, markets are going to rely on the data. So to me, coming into this week, I would say that, you know, the other data that we got out of the US, the ECI, the payrolls print, the JOLTS data, was probably more important as I'm thinking about FX markets than the FOMC itself. Now, I think, you know, just taking a step back, we'd already been highlighting in recent communications, you know, in our publications, in the podcast, that the dollar rally is maturing. We were reaching the upper end of the recent ranges. And at the end of the day, our view was that policy divergence would be eventually self-limiting, just given how synchronized this cycle is in terms of central bank, in terms of central bank cuts. At some point, we're going to have 70 to 80% of central banks cutting rates. And so when that's the direction of all central banks, you know, it's and particularly an inflation is coming down globally, it's really hard to see very wide divergences open up between currencies. And I think the other thing, you know, the things that we were concerned about in terms of near-term risks were firstly the positioning. You know, people, investors are quite long positioning along the dollar, at least on the metrics we track. Valuations, the dollar was on the upper end of the range. There was so much that had already been taken out from, you know, what was expected for the Fed relative to start of the year. And then I think most importantly to me, a pretty big offset for sort of our bullish, you know, dollar view, which, you know, which has been brewing for a few weeks, was really that growth was picking up outside the US. You know, it was coming in drips and drabs. And you know, finally, what we've seen recently is in the PMIs and in some of the latest data coming out of Europe, for example, you know, the GDP print and all that, it did surprise to the upside. And so that growth momentum has actually, you know, turned a corner, at least in Europe. And even though it's not something to really celebrate about because growth is still quite tepid compared to the US, I think it's still a turn and we have to respect that. If there's one thing we've learned from last year is that, you know, when there's a whiff of the possibility that the market could price in more Fed cuts and you combine that with some sort of growth pickup outside the US, you know, that can mean that the dollar weakens quite a bit substantially. So from a very tactical standpoint, we have been a bit more concerned for the last couple of weeks. And, you know, we have been sort of recommending some prudence and trimming of exposure around the dollar. But that's a very tactical view and sort of concerned with near-term risks. I think you have to take a look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is I sort of have the longer term view for most of 2024 is firstly inflation is still a risk. You know, we're going from data point to data point, and you know, while payrolls are soft today, we still have the next round of inflation of CPI at the middle of May, which is going to be important. So you know, while there might be some liquidation of dollar length from investors going into that event, at the end of the day, if it's another hard inflation print, then that's what the market is really going to focus on, and dollar will strengthen on the back of that. The second thing I'll say, the big picture view here is still that the carry support for the dollar is still not going to really dissipate, even with three or four cuts from the Fed. You know, at 4.5%, even if you assume four cuts from the Fed, that still leaves the dollar, which is a defensive currency, at 4.5% yield. That's more than 40% of the currencies globally. So it's still a pretty good outcome, you know, and a good incentive for investors to own this currency. And, you know, then I'll say, of course, you also have the US elections coming up. There's prospects of trade conflict and tariffs, which in turn means that the durability of the growth pickup that we're seeing in, you know, in China and Europe is actually that there's a lack of visibility on how durable that pickup is. So all of that combined is you know, even though we are sort of concerned about near-term risks here to dollar strength, I would say all of that combined still tells me that the dollar bears shouldn't really be celebrating too much just on the basis of this payrolls report.
Yeah, thanks for that. And it's interesting just to hear the parallels. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised since we both are sort of very concentrated in macro markets. The parallels we had here in both rates and FX, although I guess you had the kicker of positions being very extended as well to kind of give you that very near-term view. But if I can sort of take a step back and just hone in on something a bit more, thinking about this tactical nature of the dollar story here, you did some work on what might be the best bullish and bearish USD trades. What are the main takeaways from that exercise?
Yeah, you know, that was a stylistic exercise to get a sense of thematically what are the kind of currency pairs that do the best adjusted for volatility, you know, in dollar bearish and dollar bullish regimes. And I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, a lot of the ways to be bullish the dollars, you know, ends up being versus the low yielders, because at the end of the day, there is such a wide yield gap between the US dollar and the low yielders like Asian FX or Swiss franc or the Japanese yen, that usually what we've tended to find is that, you know, dollar, you know, if you want to be along the dollar, the carry really works in your favor in that environment. So I would say dollar expressions versus the Swiss franc, yen, the euro a little bit. I'd say the low yielding cyclical currencies like the Scandies and Aussie and, you know, and some Asian FX tend to sort of rank pretty well and pretty highly as vehicles in which you know, one can actually express a bullish dollar view. I think the crosses are interesting as well. You know, what we've generally tended to find is that, you know, within the crosses, the Canadian dollar, for example, tends to be a pretty good proxy for the US dollar. And we've sort of engaged in that theme from time to time. But generally speaking, Canadian dollar tends to outperform versus, say, the Scandies and Aussie. You know, when the dollar is outperforming, I think the you know, the regime of, you know, which people might be more interested in as well as hedges, you know, to the dollar length, you know, that is kind of more interesting as well, and carry tends to play a pretty heavy role. I'd say within the G10, generally speaking, you know, the Scandies and the Antipodeans once again, you know, tend to be really good vehicles to be, you know, if you are bearish on the dollar, it tends to be a pretty good vehicle for that. And I would say that particularly Nokia on the crosses tends to do pretty well. But I mean, you really have to take a step back. At the end of the day, the very highest yielders globally have tended to be, you know, are in emerging markets. And, you know, historically, what we found is that if you want to be really bearish the dollar, at least in the past year in this high carry environment, you know, the dollar yield is so high, you have to go to the very upper echelons of that, you know, of that yield bucket to currencies like Mexico or Brazil or ZAR or India to really get any kind of bang for the buck there. So, it, you know, the carry is informing a lot of these performances within the currency space. And it's probably worth a read if you have access to our research on that front.
Excellent. Now, I'm just going to ask you one more question, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this in a week that we've had. You know, the yen has been front and center this week. We got as high as 160, and then a U-turn, perhaps with intervention. I think there's been some sort of assumptions and guesses made as to how much the BOJ may have intervened this week at various points. What's going on here in dollar yen, and what's your outlook for yen? And then while you're at it, just for bonus points as well, can you talk to me about your view on the euro over as well?
Yeah, there's so much has happened this week. You know, it feels like the interventions from the MOF were a while ago, but no, it was this week. Look, it's become a very interesting setup. I think we've had a situation where the Bank of Japan was dovish and clearly did not show any sensitivity whatsoever to the currency weakness that we were seeing. So what we saw at the start of the week was essentially, you know, dollar yen approach 160 during a time where US yields weren't really heading higher. And that sort of usually is a trigger, you know, when dislocations like that happen, it's usually a trigger for intervention. So our estimate or our guesstimate, I would say, is that the MOF, the Ministry of Finance, did intervene twice this week. And we get some daily data on the basis of which you can approximate it from Japan. And, you know, our best guess estimates are it's 55 to 57 billion US dollars of intervention over two episodes this week. And you know, the second episode happened actually right after the FOMC, after Chair Powell's presser. So that was the handover between US and Asia time zones. It typically tends to be not that liquid and really ended up having lasting impact. Of course, the fact that US yields are lower over the week also helped dollar yen retrace a big part of the move. But look, you know, again, positioning is a factor here. I think that's what explains the viciousness of the move, dollar yen. lower again, because I would say that if I look at our positioning metrics, yen shorts and Swiss shorts are probably the most crowded and have been the most crowded. But you know, aside from sort of short term positioning issues, I think the big picture here is the Bank of Japan was dovish. Japan has the most negative real yields globally. Those real yields have gotten more negative because of policy inaction. And this comes during a period where you had a pretty substantial repricing of central banks outside of Japan in a more hawkish direction. So that yield band has gotten stretched. And in fact, what we've learned this week or the past week is that the BOJ is not that sensitive to current levels of yen. And hence, you know, the yield gap, even if we do get the Fed cutting 100 basis points this year, which is not really, you know, the expectation, at, you know, at 4.5%, that would be still a pretty wide yield gap relative relative to the yen. So I think the positioning aside, the big picture, you know, view here is that so long as the, you know, we're in a high for long rates environment, it's going to be hard to see yen make a comeback. And in fact, I would say there's an asymmetry here in terms of, you know, there is going to be, if yields, US yields are heading higher, I think dollar yen upside can be, you know, can be fairly explosive as we've seen this week. But I think the downside is going to be quite limited just given what we've learned about the BOJ reaction function. And, you know, interventions can smooth out volatility, but it can't really reverse the underlying fundamental cause for what's going on with currencies. So I think that's what we have to keep in mind as far as yen is concerned. For the euro, it's a bit of a tug of war right now, I think, because the growth momentum that started picking up in the eurozone around the turn of the year has certainly become more entrenched. We've had a fairly strong, you know, Q1 outcome, which is actually quite a contrast to what the concern was back in November and December, where we were thinking that Europe could be slipping into recession. So that's a pretty decent outcome there. And at the same time, you know, we got some softer U.S. data, which looks like it might suggest that the Fed actually could be able to be cutting, you know, more than just once this year. So I think both of those factors do limit how much lower, you know, euro dollar can go. So our targets, you know, for euro dollar were 105. I think we're going to be maintaining those, but certainly the growth, you know, the growth turnaround is something that we have to respect and tends to be usually quite euro supportive. I think the ECB's intent to cut rates in June, but that's already well priced in. So if it's coming in an improving growth environment and then the rate cut extends that shelf life, of course, you know, that typically is an environment in which the euro does strengthen. But I think we also have to be mindful of risks down the road, such as potential for trade conflicts and some of the other structural issues that the eurozone is facing. So still maintaining our 105 targets, but respecting this growth move higher.
Got it. Thanks for that. So if I can just kind of summarize a few things I've heard as we've been talking over the last 20 minutes or so, while we both, you know, feel comfortable that the kind of trends that we've seen in rates and FX this year are certainly more mature, and that this week's developments sort of, I think, indicate that as well, we both think that there's a major amount of event risk up ahead, and that's inflation in just about, I think, 10 days time or so, because it's inflation that the Fed cares about the most. But I think, you know, perhaps in contrast from our perspective, you know, we might be looking to counter trade this at the front end, given the support that we've seen in some rate levels there. And then finally on intervention and on intervention flows, if they did occur, and it seems like they did, it helps sort of slow the descent in the yen. But structurally here, given the relative differentiation between the Fed and BOJ, it doesn't sort of change the medium-term dynamics there, if I heard all this right. And Mira, just wanted to say thanks so much for the conversation today. It's been a long week and a busy week in rates and FX markets, and appreciate you taking the time. And again, thanks to all of our listeners here. So stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan Research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Company. All rights reserved. This episode was recorded on May 3rd, 2024.